Burr against Chicago. Mr. Fox.
Good morning, Your Honor. Ed Fox on behalf of the plaintiff's appellate. This case is here following a trial for false arrest and excessive use of force. The case was in large part a swearing contest between the plaintiffs and the defendants, primarily on the issue of whether the plaintiff was gratuitously shoved by one of the officers headfirst into a cement bench, causing him to have a gash in his head requiring 12 stitches, or whether, according to the officers, he simply fell because he was falling down drunk. As the district court noted in its opinion, the issue of plaintiff's drinking was, quote,
I'm not happy with your with your brief, with your abuse of Judge Badara. I don't think I've ever read a brief like this. You call his reasoning nonsensical, more nonsensical, call it absurd. You go on and on. You talk about his confusion.
I apologize.
You may disagree with him. Some dubious reasoning that remains nonsensical. That's typical. It goes on and on.
Your Honor, I apologize for that, and I think some of it was born out of frustration at the way the trial progressed. And
I think your charge that he's biased has no basis. But what bothers me, actually, the most, is something you say on page 27 of your brief. You're saying that, at the bottom, the court admonished Mr. Pizziak, how do you pronounce it, by saying, where's the effect? I will ask you to wait until the answer is completed before you object. And you say, most troubling, besides the fact that this is an error, was done in a hostile tone. I don't understand this reference to error. What this fellow, your associate, CZS, how do you pronounce his name?
Kaizak.
Pardon?
Kaizak.
So what Kaizak did was, instead of objecting to a question to which one could object, he interrupted the answer. The answers are being given by his own witness, the client. Now, you're defending that. That's extremely improper. If the question can be objected to, you object to the question. And the witness is instructed that he can't answer until the objection has been ruled on. You don't let the question be asked, let the witness start to answer, and then by interrupting the witness, disrupt the cross-examination. Now, that Kaizak did that repeatedly. The judge got very annoyed. You say, no, there was no error, or that the judge was in error, and then it becomes part of your argument for the judge being biased.
Well, Your Honor, what was happening was the questioning and answers were going very fast.
So you tell the questioner to slow up, or if the answer is coming too fast, tell the judge, tell the witness he's got to slow down because the opposing lawyer has to have an opportunity, if he wants to object to the question, object to the question.
I agree, and we tried to do that with the court, just what Your Honor says, and we weren't permitted to do it. We went to a sidebar. We said, Judge, we would like to ask him to slow down. The questions and answers are coming too fast. It didn't happen. He didn't ask them to do that. So we were just prevented from doing that, as well as just prevented from doing a lot of things.
It sounds like Judge Darrow was telling Mr. Kaizak that he was using a tactic to interrupt the witness to his advantage, and that was improper.
I agree that that may be what it reads like, Judge, but, you know, during the course of the trial, and it was heated, for much of the trial. For example, Judge Darrow called me unethical because I asked him at sidebar
now,
off.
You're now getting away from the question.
Okay.
What prevented you, for example, from asking the district judge to ask the witness to take a breath and count to three before answering a question?
Mr. Barber's testimony.
Did anything prevent you from asking the district judge to instruct the witness?
We told.
To delay.
Answering that specific question, nothing prevented us from asking
okay.
that.
And you never did ask the judge to tell the witness to slow down.
We did what we could with the judge.
No, you didn't do what you could. I've just told you one thing you could have done, and you've conceded you didn't do it.
Your Honor, and I don't want to dwell on this. You're asking.
Your brief dwells on it at length, and as Judge Posner said, you abuse the judge, you use words like absurd, you say the judge obviously was biased for making this ruling, and when you say something like that, what it tells the court is that you not only have lost your objectivity, but you haven't read controlling decisions of the Supreme Court, like Lateke, which make your argument of bias legally frivolous and a ground of sanctions.
I did say in our reply brief, Your Honor, that I recognize that the bar is very high for that. With that, and I didn't want to belabor the point.
You seem to be utterly unaware of the governing legal standards for that charge.
Your Honor, what happened was, and the main source of the errors were twofold. One was the pretrial conference in which motions in limine were ruled upon, but there was never an order issued. And then the second basis, or the second category of errors, were evidentiary rulings that occurred. The most prominent one that we take issue with was the admitting into evidence of an arrest that occurred 4 years subsequent to the incident in question. The arrest was 4 years subsequent, a misdemeanor arrest for drinking. There was no conviction. The arrest happened to take place at the same place where the arrest in this case took place. And when the questions were asked about this, it violated a motion in limine not to ask generalized questions about drinking, but counsel for the defense did that. The plaintiff
answered. The motion in limine seemed to go to whether he had a drinking problem.
Correct.
If I recall from reading the transcript of that, not whether he had ever drunk.
Well, the question was, you don't drink, period. The implication was ever.
Right, which was different than the motion in limine.
Well,
the motion in limine was about whether he had an alcohol problem.
And then in the course of the motion, in course of the pretrial conference, the court said to them, you're only going to ask about drinking on that day, aren't you? And they said, yes. So that was the focus and what we thought in our minds what was going on. So that wasn't the question that was put to the witness. Did you drink on that day? It was, you don't drink, period. And so then we objected, asked for a sidebar. At the sidebar, defense says they want to bring in the subsequent arrest for drinking 4 years later. We vigorously objected, saying that doesn't prove that he was drinking. He was arrested but not convicted. The judge overruled us. Defense counsel paraded a document that purported, he wasn't allowed to put the document in, but says, asked witness, this document has a lot of information about you, doesn't it? And then he's permitted to ask the witness, isn't it true you were arrested for drinking? Witness said, yes, he was, and then proceeded to explain what happened. The judge then, without fronting it with us, gave a limiting instruction. And we didn't know the limiting instruction was coming. And he says, tell the jury that this could be used for credibility issues. And then he says to me, is that all you wish for the jury to be instructed on? Well, I didn't wish the jury to be instructed on that at all. And it gave the notion that the court was calling the plaintiff a liar, because right after he testifies, I was arrested for drinking. Following his testimony that he says he doesn't drink, the implication was he's a drinker and he's lying about the very issue of which the trial is about. So that testimony in and of itself was highly damaging, and it was erroneous to let in propensity evidence, which that was, clearly. And in connection with the instructing the jury and not giving us an opportunity to know what the instruction was and to say anything about it was a second error in connection with it. And this was the beginning of the second day of the plaintiff's testimonies. on the stand, and it began to trickle.
He had been on the stand the preceding day.
Correct.
And then for a part of that day.
Correct.
This is one piece of evidence in a trial of, what, 3 or 4 days?
It was 3 to 4 days, yes.
It's hard for me to see how it could have pivoted on that piece of evidence.
Well, it was pivotal for three reasons, Your Honor. One, this was a case about whether he was drinking or not. The subsequent arrest was for drinking. It was pivotal because, two, the arrest took place at the same place as the incident that we were there for. And three, the limiting instruction the judge gave implied the plaintiff was lying about that, but he wasn't. He didn't say I'd never been arrested before. He just said I never drank. So on those three grounds, telling the plaintiff he's lying about the issues in the case was highly pivotal. And then following that, the next thing that came up was plaintiff, on direct, one question was asked of him about emotional distress. One question. He gave a one-sentence answer. He says, I'm embarrassed because I had these stitches and my face was messed up. That was his answer. So on cross-examination, he says that I'm afraid of these police here in this room. And that was it. That was the extent of his testimony. From that, they then want to get a rehearing on getting the felony conviction in. Judge Darrow offered the theory to the defense for doing it, saying that's an intervening cause of his damages then, because he had a felony conviction of his emotional distress damages, because he had a felony conviction and he subsequently went to prison for it, then you could use it for that. But the fact is, the plaintiff only testified on direct that he was embarrassed because he had this scar on his face.
Well, in your opening or closing arguments, did you discuss emotional distress as a component of his damages?
Very little. I mean, the main thing I dealt with in the closing argument was this 4-year misdemeanor arrest, because it weighed so heavily on the whole trial. So I kept saying to the jury in my closing argument, this case is what happened on this particular date. It had nothing to do with what happened 4 years later. So the judge gives lets the felony conviction come in, doesn't do an appropriate balancing, gives a limiting instruction to the jury and says, you can use this for damages. But there was no testimony on damages that was contradicted or impeached by the felony conviction. It never happened. So, and then the questions were asked, not in the way of asking about damages, but the questions were asked as if it was impeaching. In a general sense, you use felony convictions to impeach. Isn't it true you've got this felony conviction? And then they never related it back to damages. And they couldn't, because his testimony wouldn't have permitted it. So then, that was the second piece of evidence that came out on the second day.
Is it correct that his rulings on motions in limine, that there's no transcript?
Correct. No, there is a transcript on the motions. Yes, there was a transcript. And that was...
There's a transcript of his rulings.
There's a transcript of the proceedings and what he says. And so, for example, he wouldn't let me bring in the prior inconsistent statements saying he ruled that the motions in limine, they couldn't come in. That never happened. You examine the transcript.
So there is a complete transcript.
There is a complete transcript on that. And that was part of our frustration during the trial, is that the rulings kept changing during the course of the trial of what we thought it was. So the third thing that happened on the second day of his testimony was that the defendants then read roughly, they took almost 20 minutes to a half an hour reading 10 pages of his deposition testimony. And the point was that he was substantially consistent with his trial testimony, except he confused the two officers of which did what. He was 14 when the incident happened. His deposition was taken 5 years later. We tried to rehabilitate him using a statement he gave 2 days after the incident where he correctly identifies the officer. The judge says, no, you can't use it. Why can't we use it? Not because it's a prior consistent statement or any evidentiary merit, but because that's how I ruled on the motion in limine. But it's not how he ruled on the motion in limine. And in fact, in the defendant's motion in limine motion, they expressly excluded the plaintiff's statement from their motion. And so we were repeatedly getting frustrated and frustrated and frustrated. So we couldn't rehabilitate him with his 2 day later statement given to OPS. So that was the entirety of his day of testimony, and that's what we were left with. And
let me ask on a different front. He's described as having been at the time of the arrest 5'1", of course 14 years old, and skinny. Is there evidence about his weight?
I think there was evidence from the police report. He was 120 pounds, I believe.
So it's in the police report?
I believe so.
Thank you.
And I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Fox. Ms. Peckold.
May it please the court. This case was tried to a jury over 4 days. The jury heard from 6 witnesses.
I'm extremely upset about the question about his arrest for drinking. That seems to me extraordinarily damaging and completely unjustified.
Your Honor, we do not concede that the admission of the arrest was error, but we believe that the court need not reach
that
question.
How could it be proper to allow that in?
Your Honor, Mr. Barber had made sweeping denials on a couple of issues.
Being arrested, kids arrested, bunch of kids drinking, and it would be entirely possible, and I would think likely, that they just arrest all the kids and sort out later which ones were actually drinking. I think to put that in a case like this, to drag that arrest in, I think that's terrible. I don't think you can get I don't think a kid like this can get a fair trial with an arrest like that in the record. And I think the prosecutor should be heavily censured for bringing that in.
Your Honor, Mr. Barber had made these expansive and sweeping denials. One was that he had not ever had a drink.
But being arrested doesn't prove your guilt, right? You start bringing in people's arrest records, and there's no authority for doing that. Any authority for bringing in. I mean, you can imagine. We've had cases where, for example, a person had, 40 arrests, and the sentencing judge wanted to consider that. And we said, fine, because 40 arrests tells you something about this person. But one arrest with other kids and drinking beer or something doesn't tell you anything.
Well, Your Honor, the standard
and
is abusive.
It's very prejudicial. It's very prejudicial.
We do think that it was...
I don't understand allowing that in.
Your Honor,
have to do with with credibility?
We don't believe that Mr. Barber has shown prejudice in light of the record as a whole.
I also don't like the business of the conviction. I mean, I can understand some tenuous connection to emotional distress damages request, but again, and you put it together with the arrest. I don't see how this guy gets a fair trial.
Well, Your Honor, these were both brief exchanges in the context of a testimony that went from one day over to the next. And we've also outlined in our brief
did the prosecution mention in its closing argument?
Your Honor, I'm not aware of that, but I can check. But as to the felony conviction, we don't believe it is a basis to reverse because the jury could not have considered it. The judge instructed the jury.
Oh, come on. You've got to be realistic about these instructions.
Well, Your Honor, there's case law from the circuit that the court presumes juries follow their instructions.
Oh, come on. Who believes that? I mean, there are some instructions that, of course, can be followed. But an instruction that tells you not to think about something, how can that be? Who actually thinks that those instructions are followed? People wipe their memories clean? Is that what happens?
Well, Your Honor, the court has cases saying that we do presume that the jury's
followed. Well, you know, courts say a lot of things that offend common sense.
We also contend that Barber did not make in the opening brief any argument that he was prejudiced by the conviction. And so that's a separate ground not to rely on the conviction as a basis for reversal. We also believe that the evidence was harmless, again, for if you consider the record as a whole, and this goes for all of the evidentiary issues, we think that there were numerous other reasons why the jury would have concluded
well,
that Barber
was
not
believable.
Well,
what's a good other reason? The police officer's testimony is not very good. That seems to have been very confused.
Yes,
well, not, although that often happens quite innocently. I'm not attached. Well, what would you say is the most powerful evidence of his lack of his weakness of his claim?
Your Honor, it's really a series of issues with his testimony. He said that he testified on how long he was outside in front of the building. That testimony was questionable. He was very inconsistent on that. He didn't know how long he waited.
I don't understand. What difference does it make?
Because the question, his claim was he was outside waiting for his mother to bring groceries, but the testimony of the police was that the security guards told them that he was outside hanging around and causing a disturbance. So it went to what exactly was he doing out there. He testified he didn't recall seeing his mother at the hospital. She testified two officers took her to the hospital and she saw him there. He did not recall refusing to give his mother's phone number
now
at the hospital.
How far in the past are these events that he's testifying to?
It was several years by the time of trial.
Well, then there's likely to be mistakes both by him and by the police. So why is that so devastating to him?
There were things that he said that you would think you would remember even after. Like he testified that after he was injured, an unknown female officer came to him in the lockup, uncuffed him, let him go to the bathroom by himself to clean up. That's not something that you'd misrecall even after a few years, and that was unbelievable for safety reasons.
Why is that unbelievable? If this is a kid, he's only 5'1" and weighs 120 pounds. Why would he frighten this female officer? How tall is she?
Well, there isn't evidence in the record about that, Your Honor. But
why not? You think it's unbelievable? If she was 5'1", weighed 90 pounds, yeah, then I would agree with you. What if she could be 5'10" and weigh 150 pounds? Right, is a little nobody, and she feels sorry for him. He's a kid, and his head is cut. So she takes a small chance, right? Why is that so unbelievable?
Well, Your Honor, it just opens the door for an officer to hurt themselves. But
yes, I know. But why is it? If he is harmless looking, he's got his head is bashed, and he's a shrimp. Why would every woman? These are women police officers, not just ordinary women. Why would you assume that this woman would be frightened of this guy? And even though he's bleeding, she goes running off to get some big burly police to escort her. Maybe that's all that somewhat more likely. I don't see that as devastating evidence of his.
In addition, he also said that he never saw the officers again after the incident, but then he was confronted with his deposition in which he had claimed that he did see one of the officers the day of the presidential election. Then he said he did remember that incident.
But the police officers gave a lot of contradictory evidence.
I'm not sure that they did, Your Honor. I thought that they generally testified pretty consistently, that they thought that he was intoxicated and that he told them he was drinking this liquor. And even the statements that the plaintiff complains about, I thought were quite consistent with their trial testimony. If you lay them side by side in those statements to the OPS, they said that that Mr. Barber was intoxicated and fell because of his intoxication.
Well, Shields said that, but then later says he wasn't even in the police station when that supposedly happened. Doesn't he contradict himself?
He does not contradict himself on that issue, Your Honor. He testified consistently that he thought Barber was intoxicated when he interacted with him at the
Right, but in
site.
Terms of the fault where he hit his head and so forth, at one point doesn't Shields say he was present for that and then another time say he wasn't?
No, Your Honor. I don't think Officer Shields ever said that. I think he said that he was parking the car while all of the events inside the police station, including the fall, happened.
Well, that suggests he didn't see it, right?
That's right. He did not. Officer Shields never claimed to have seen the fall in the police station. Only Officer Malinuk was escorting Mr. Barber into the police station. Your Honor, we don't believe that the exclusion of any of the OPS statements warrants reversal. We believe that Mr. Barber has waived these arguments on appeal by not explaining the prejudice from these statements. We don't believe that even if there was any error, there was any prejudice from the exclusion of these statements. As I just explained, the
and
only...
And why were they excluded?
They were excluded on the basis of the district court's pretrial ruling. And at the pretrial conference, the court excluded the entire underlying CR or OPS investigation.
Why?
That was on the basis of the plaintiff's agreement not to use the files. And, Your Honor, we will rest on our brief as to the last two arguments by Mr. Barber relating to trial management and bias. If there are no further questions, we respectfully request that the court affirm.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Fox?
Just a few quick points. As far as the pretrial ruling, and we never agreed that we weren't going to use prior inconsistent statements of the officers. We agreed we wouldn't use prior CRs from other prior events, but we never agreed about this case. That's clear, and that's in the record. The second thing is, in connection with plaintiff's testimony, plaintiff never gave any testimony that was inconsistent on any material issue. On any material issue at all, he was not inconsistent. The only thing he got wrong, he confused the two officers 5 years after the incident at a deposition, and we weren't permitted to rehabilitate him. As far as the officers' testimony goes, they testified so bizarre because they knew the medical testimony did not support the fact that he was drunk because he went to the doctor. He was taken to the hospital, and there was no indication in the medical record of any sign or symptom consistent with alcohol ingestion. We made a big deal about that. So what happened was, because since that showed he wasn't drunk, then we had a picture of our client taking a booking that we showed for just a couple hours later where you could see he didn't have bloodshot eyes and he didn't look drunk. And what the officers knew, we had the picture and the medical testimony. What they did, they tried to soften the testimony that he was falling down drunk. So they literally testified on the stand that when he was asked, they said he was not falling down drunk. That was their testimony. Yes. So we're saying, so if you're saying he fell down because he was drunk, how come you're saying he was not falling down drunk? And we kept going back and forth with this.
Let it finish, please.
So we kept going back and forth with this, and their testimony was just bizarre. So they wanted to say he's falling down drunk. And the final thing in terms of the officer's inconsistent testimony, they testified that the security guard signed a complaint saying that the plaintiff did very specific acts. Then it turned out that the security guard did not sign the complaint because it couldn't have been written at the time he signed it because they didn't have a typewriter at the scene. And so they admitted that he didn't sign the complaint as it was written. And that's all in part of the transcript.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Case will be taken under advisement.